This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. 2023 was the hottest year in recorded history, and the record-breaking heat has continued into this year. So what has all this meant for public health and the way people's bodies are reacting to these rising temperatures? Joining me now to talk about that and how to spot the signs of heat-related illness and stay safe are University of Cincinnati emergency medicine physician, Dr. Dustin Calhoun. Welcome, Dr. Calhoun.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks for being here. And University of Cincinnati Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine, Dr. Woods Curry. Thanks for being here, Dr. Curry.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both. Dr. Calhoun, as I mentioned, 2023 was the hottest year on record. We're coming off of 13 consecutive months of record-breaking heat. What kind of impact is all of this having on our health?
Well, heat-related illness is really a significant spectrum of what you can see. You know, I know the first question people always want to know is, are you seeing more of this in the emergency department? And surprisingly, we really haven't. We looked at that fairly recently and haven't seen an increased number of patients. And fortunately, I think that means that both our, you know, the public entities, as well as information services such as yourselves, have done a great job of making sure people know what to do. I think we've been very fortunate there.
Yeah. Dr. Calhoun, have you seen an increase in the number of emergency department patients who have heat-related illnesses?
No, we haven't, which, again, is a surprise. It's a large spectrum of illness, and there are extremes that we see. Some of the extreme ends are things like heat stroke, where you would see a patient with altered mental status, thinking or acting differently. And in certain circumstances, we see those when we see big events like Riverbend, when we see races like the Flying Pig Marathon. We certainly see large increases at those times. But we really haven't seen them just overall in the emergency department. Hmm.
Dr. Curry, I've read that many experts believe heat-related illnesses and deaths are underreported in the U.S. What do you think about that?
Oh, that is certainly the case. Absolutely. We don't have a great reporting system for tracking this. Certainly, as our climate changes, as we, I think we've all experienced this year, especially, that it was hotter faster than it usually is, we don't get an opportunity to acclimatize to that heat. And acclimatization is really the most important thing that you can do to sort of, in addition to breaks and rests and things like that, in order to kind of prevent heat illness.
Explain what acclimatization is, and I feel like this must come into play when it goes from like 50 to 90 overnight, which it seems like it did.
Absolutely.
This summer.
Yeah. Absolutely. So acclimatization is just sort of getting your body used to the heat. I grew up in Mississippi. Dr. Calhoun actually grew up in Georgia. So the heat is pretty high down there. Someone who's used to that sort of heat can go out in a hot day and not to be affected. But if you're from somewhere that you're not used to that, it's way more important that you get out and do a little bit of exercise with more rest. Increasing that over time. And there are certainly like published ways if you're going to be playing like American football, for instance, there are published like practice schedules for how you sort of acclimatize to start the season.
And I would imagine that's important if you work outside, too. If you get a new job, you're not all of a sudden, bam, outside every day, 8 hours a day.
Absolutely. OSHA has pretty good guidelines for how people who work outside in the heat should acclimatize and then should manage their work rest periods when they're working out in the heat.
Yeah. Dr. Calhoun, can you explain for us kind of the range of heat-related illnesses from mild to the most severe? What kind of symptoms do people see?
Sure. On the extreme end is heat stroke, which, as mentioned earlier, the real thing there, the hallmark of heat stroke is altered mental status. So thinking or acting strangely differently than that person would normally. And that can and progress all the way to things like seizures and stroke and ultimately the detrimental end of permanent brain damage and death. But along the way, there are much more less severe symptoms that you can have and a huge range, anything from headaches to nausea and vomiting, dizziness, body aches. We see people with muscle cramps and then even things like there are skin rashes that can come from heat. I think the thing that's really important for people to keep in mind is that there isn't an absolute temperature. People always want that, right? Is there a temperature that I can measure that then I have heat illness? And there really isn't. It's how your body is responding to different temperatures. And then the other one is sweat. People like to really hinge on, am I sweating or am I not? Because I was always taught in first aid that if I'm not sweating, then that means heat stroke. And if I'm sweating, I can't have heat stroke. And it's much more complicated than that. And with or without sweat, you can wind up anywhere on this spectrum of illness.
Do you want to add to that, Dr. Curry?
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, the the hallmark of heat stroke is really that altered mental status. And it's not just a frank confusion. I mean, we've seen athletes who finished a high-performing activity and then just can't stop crying for some reason, who have elevated core body temperatures. So kind of any change from normal mental status is really the hallmark of heat stroke.
Hmm. We're talking about heat-related illnesses, how to recognize the signs, and how to stay safe. Do you have questions about how to stay safe in the heat? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Calhoun, you were just talking about people ask about a temperature, and it sounded like you were talking about a core body temperature. It's like, is this what my body temperature is, and is that the hallmark of having a heat-related illness? But is there a certain temperature outside that's kind of the point at which we should be concerned? How hot does it need to be outside to start to cause health problems? And what role do factors like humidity play in all that?
Those are great questions. And unfortunately, I don't have a great simple answer. I think you really hit the nail on the head there near the end about humidity. People pay a lot of attention to the temperature outside, but the most important is probably heat index, which has a better predictive value of how well you can cool yourself, because that's really what this is. This is the human body not being able to get rid of the heat that it's producing and the heat that it's absorbing. So the more humid it is, the higher the heat index, that affects it. But it's also dependent on a lot of other things. You can dress yourself into heat injury. You can wear clothing that doesn't breathe well. You can stay out in the sun. It's amazing how much shade does. Every once in a while, you see people walking around with no rain in the sun carrying an umbrella. It's actually a fantastic idea. The difference in temperature from shade to sun makes a huge difference in your susceptibility. And then it harkens back to what Dr. Curry was saying earlier, about your body's adaptation to it. Some people sweat more efficiently than others and can lead to better protection from that heat.
Do you want to add to that, Dr.
Well, I would say that one of the ways we can track this is what's called the wet bulb globe temperature, which takes into account relative humidity, and those kinds of things. Just for instance, today in Cincinnati, the wet bulb globe temperature is about 76 degrees right now. It'll get up a little bit higher, and especially when we're talking about like athletes and sports, there are well published guidelines for what kind of athletic activity you should be doing and what your rest work breaks should be, and what kind of like your emergency action plan needs to plan for, dependent upon that wet bulb globe temperature.
How educated are coaches and trainers and just schools generally about this wet bulb globe temperature? Did I say those words in the right order?
Wet bulb globe temperature.
Okay, that's I know I've read that, and I was worried I was going to get it all mixed up in my head. How educated are people about the importance of that? Because that's kind of a new-ish way of looking at all this, isn't it?
Absolutely. So I think that, athletic trainers specifically are very well educated in it. I always say that athletic trainers are the intersection of sports medicine and emergency medicine. They really are kind of experts in this. I hope that a lot of coaches are getting way more educated, especially as, we have hotter and hotter summers. And then that they have integrated this into their school-specific emergency action plans, including having cold water immersion baths when the wet bulb globe temperature. See, I did it wrong.
Wet bulb globe temperature is
in the elevated range.
Does that must require a special device to take that wet bulb globe temperature? Is that something that every school should have?
There is a device you can purchase that certainly measures that. But your local area. So that I have an app on my phone that tells me what it is here in Cincinnati. I think it measures it probably at the airport, which is probably better than nothing, obviously.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Dr. Calhoun, who's at greatest risk of having heat-related illnesses? I'm wondering if there are particular age groups or demographics we should be worried about, or if it's more based on whether you're working outside or spending lots of time outside for sports or athletic practices.
It can be all of those things. And if you get very technical with heat injury, there are sort of two large groups of heat injury. One of which more affecting the elderly, typically sort of classic heat illness, versus exertional heat illness, more affecting athletes. And what factors really play into a person's susceptibility to those kind of depends on which one you're talking about. Certainly things that people don't tend to think about are medications. So particularly in the elderly population, there are certain medications, and some of them are fairly common blood pressure medications or mental health medications that can make someone more susceptible to heat injury. Your level of hydration is a significant part of it. If you really think about heat illness, a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it boils down to dehydration. So maintaining one's heat or hydration status is a major part of our susceptibility. And then simple things like your genetics can certainly play into it. What activities you're doing, how well you're regulating when you're taking these breaks, and what environment you're doing these in. Air circulation is a huge part of it. Our ability to get rid of heat is significantly influenced by how often there's a breeze blowing across our skin. So your environment as you do these activities significantly play into it as well.
Dr. Curry, Dr. Calhoun was just talking about medications, and certainly there are a lot of older people who take blood pressure medications, medication for mental health, but there are also a lot of young people who take medication, whether it's for ADHD or anxiety or depression. How much should that factor into decisions about training and athletics and sports? I mean, I got to believe there are some kids playing football out there who are taking medicine that could make them more susceptible to heat injury.
Absolutely. And you hit the nail on the head of the exact medicines that we're thinking about. I mean, certainly, you know, those medicines are required. And so we're not going to suggest at all anyone stop taking their medications. But if you're on those medications, you just want to be extra cautious. Make sure you prehydrate, because as Dr. Calhoun mentioned, evaporative cooling is actually our body's primary way of dissipating heat. And so you need to have plenty of fluids in order to be able to sweat. So hydration is incredibly important. And then making sure you are very careful with acclimatization, especially if you're going to start a new activity or sport, or if there has been a sudden change in the weather and it's much hotter than it had been previously. You just want to be extra cautious if you're on those medications.
Yeah, and I guess even a sudden change in medication could mean
absolutely
you have to pay attention to that. What's the best way for a young athlete to hydrate? I'm a water person myself, I will confess, but I know a lot of young people like the stuff you buy in a bottle that looks like lightning bug guts and has all kinds of different stuff in there.
Sure. In general, it's going to be, you know, electrolyte solutions or water, not things that contain caffeine, because those can actually be dehydrating, despite the fact they're a liquid, because of effects on your kidneys. So, you know, a lot of the energy drinks and things are not hydrating at all. I would not consider that. So, you know, electrolyte-containing solutions, Powerade, Gatorade, and just plain old water works pretty good.
Okay. We got an email from Megan. Megan writes, I'm a 38-year-old white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed female, and I'm finding it more and more difficult to be outdoors in the heat. I get headaches, dizziness, and mental fog. It's especially difficult in the high humidity of Cincinnati. Can I climatize myself in the summer, or is it just a case of aging in the wrong climate? You're smiling, Dr. Curry. Do you have thoughts about this?
Well, you know, I moved here from Mississippi, and I thought it was so cool, but now I've lived here for almost a decade, and the heat gets to me here as well. That may be because also I'm also getting older,
yeah,
as well, for sure.
Man, 38 does not seem old to me. I'm a lot older than that. Dr. Curry, Dr. Calhoun, do you have advice for Megan? I mean, does she have hope? She's only 38. I mean, she can't just, is there a way she can get used to this heat a little better?
Certainly. You know, some of it is the things that we've been mentioning with the hydration. Certainly the things that she is describing qualify as on the spectrum of heat illness, having that mental fog, having those headaches. Absolutely. One thing that I find a lot of folks do that probably isn't helping is the extremes of temperature. So if you spend your majority of your time in your house with your air conditioning turned, you know, I don't know what you want to turn it way up or way down, very cold, and then just go out for spurts into the heat, certainly that isn't helping your acclimatization. So some amount of allowing yourself to adapt to an environment is helpful. That said, that air conditioning, absolutely, when you have those symptoms, is necessary to help you cool. And we certainly don't want anyone to be miserable. But I do find that sometimes this back and forth between extreme temperatures leads to more symptoms for folks than they necessarily would have to experience otherwise.
Would Megan be a good candidate to maybe carry an umbrella around when in the sunshine, even if it's not raining, to kind of reduce that temperature a bit?
Oh, absolutely. And there are so many things that 100 years ago we all did as just part of, I don't know if it was fashion or function, but it was very common to carry either a true umbrella or a camisole, you know, lace umbrella kind of thing, People wore hats more commonly, which can also help with your cooling by providing shade around your head. So there are many adaptive things, clothing as well. If you look in very, very hot, sunny climates, people are not running around in skin exposure, which you would think would be cooler. They're fully covered up, but using the right kind of loose-fitting, very, very breathable clothing can make a big difference as well.
Bringing back the parasol here on Cincinnati Edition. That's what we're going to do today. The Biden administration has proposed rules to protect workers from the heat, both people who work outside and inside, to make sure people have access to shade, water, and air conditioning. Dr. Calhoun, what are some of the hazardous conditions people might work under? I imagine you see people who work in places where they have heat injury in the emergency room.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I did construction. I was an electrician before going to medical school. And it was a very big deal on job sites, even back then. I mean, we're talking 20 some odd years ago. But it was a big deal. And different employers did a better or worse job of protecting their employees. And it made a big difference. So certainly we think of outside, we think of the person, you know, in the full sun in the middle of the summer. But there are plenty of indoor jobs where you have lack of any sort of good air circulation, very high humidity, significantly higher than you might encounter outside, and then a slightly lower temperature indoors can still actually be just as or more dangerous. So any sort of a job potentially has the ability to cause heat illness if the right precautions aren't taken.
Dr. Curry, what do you think those precautions should be? What should employers be doing to make sure their workers are safe?
Yeah, especially people that work outside, I think, you know, paying attention to the temperatures and the recommendations, making sure that you have mandated work rest cycles so that, you know, employees aren't feeling like they can't take a break or that, you know, it's just when they quote unquote feel tired or feel unwell, like you actually institute this as a part of your occupational safety program, that you have mandated breaks in the heat.
Yeah. Dr. Curry, what about coaches and schools? Do you think they're becoming more aware of risks for student athletes?
Yeah, I really think that they are. And I would refer people, if you're looking for some resources on this, to the Corey Stringer Institute, which is a fantastic institute that was built out of a tragedy, a death of a professional athlete. And they have done a fantastic job, I think, of really getting the awareness of exertional heat stroke out to coaches and athletes, and providing a ton of resources for, you know, what schools and other places should be doing to be mindful of this.
And what are some of the things they should be doing during practices and training? Because, you know, I feel like a lot of these young athletes want to push. They're trying to impress the coach. Maybe they're trying to impress somebody in the stands, trying to get scholarships. What should these schools and coaches and trainers be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the whole thing is, again, built around your wet bulb globe temperature and then kind of recommendations for clothing, recommendations for how much you should be practicing or exercising, and then mandatory breaks. We're going to practice for 20 minutes and then we're going to take a 10-minute break and everyone's going to stop and everyone's going to drink some water or some Gatorade or whatever. That's no question about that, so that we can make sure we keep everyone safe.
Yeah. Dr. Calhoun, you were talking about how some of these things that Megan was experiencing, these headaches, the dizziness, the mental fog, that those are some warning signs that, hey, your body's not reacting to this heat well. You might be experiencing some heat injury. What should people do if they start to feel that way? Or is it just get into the air conditioning as soon as you can? What should you be doing if you start to feel those signs?
Sure. That's a great question. And it again comes down very much to circumstance. So I think anyone experiencing significant alteration of how they think or feel or confusion, anyone who witnesses someone out in the heat passing out or having a seizure, those are things that require immediate professional medical help. That's a call 911 kind of a thing. Both because the kind of heat illness that is describing or related to is detrimental, but also because there are other things. You know, you can be hot and still have a regular stroke, not a heat stroke. And we want to get people the help they need for those quickly. When it comes to other things, though, it very much depends on your circumstances. If you're a young person who's out in your yard working and you begin to have cramps in your muscles and you're able to go inside, get in the air conditioner, put a cool rag on your palms, the soles of your feet, on the back of your neck, your forehead, you can hydrate some and make yourself feel better. Well, that's fantastic. That's all you need to do. On the other hand, if you're an elderly person who's living in a house whose air conditioner has just broken and you begin to have some headache and nausea, well, that alone may necessitate calling 911. That may need help there because that's a circumstance where they're not going to be able to fix it or overcome those problems on their own. So it just depends on who you are and what circumstances you're in.
Dr. Curry, what do you think parents and caregivers should look for when it comes to signs of heat-related illness in children and athletes? I mean, if you're watching your son or daughter practice out in the heat, what kind of signs should you be watching for?
Yeah, certainly you're going to watch for kind of any abnormal behavior. Stumbling might be kind of one of the first things that you'll see, kind of looking, swaying, not kind of looking right. I mean, parents know their kids really well. I'm always impressed at a parent's ability just to look at their kid and say, hey, they're not right, when they seem pretty normal to me. But just anything that is out of the ordinary, you know, they go the wrong direction and you know they wouldn't normally do that, especially, you know, when it's a hot day. And those are signs that you need to kind of be very, very careful.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Calhoun, what's your best advice for just preventing these heat-related illnesses altogether? If you want to get out, it's cooler this week, but it's been blazingly hot earlier this summer. If you want to get out and exercise or go for a walk, what do you need to do to make sure you're staying safe?
Just a combination of small, easy, cheap preventative things you can do. You know your medications. If you take them, look them up. Are these medicines, or talk to your doctor, are they ones that make me at higher risk? Make sure that you're taking some sort of hydration with you. Have a, you know, carry around a water bottle, or find, you know, get one of those little backpacks that has a little water bladder in it. Just always have access to water. If you don't have access to water easily and cheaply, many people will get dehydrated. They won't take the effort to go buy something, or maybe they can't do that. So having somewhere to put that water, seeking out shade, finding ways to, you know, you'll see people doing exertional activities in the sun when they could move over 5 feet and be in the shade. Seek out that shade, those sort of things. Look.
Great tips. I've been talking with University of Cincinnati emergency medicine physician, Dr. Dustin Calhoun, and University of Cincinnati associate professor of emergency medicine, Dr. Woods Curry. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. And Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening, and stay safe out there.